How do we nurture creative, connected, resilient, emotionally intelligent, and empowered children? And they say it takes a village. So if you're feeling overwhelmed by the responsibility, you're not alone. I believe we can change the narrative for our children, but to do that, we need to change our story. Hello, it's great to have you with me. I'm Kim Clyden, former ABC radio presenter and children's book author, creating a community of people who care about children. Australia has one of the highest rates of land clearing in the world and the fourth highest extinction rate on the planet. In our fast-growing regions, nature is being replaced by rooftops and roads at an alarming pace. But what if the answer isn't just protesting? What if it's planting? What if restoring biodiversity could begin in a space no bigger than a tennis court? Today I'm speaking with Anna Noon, co-founder of the Groundswell Collective, a passionate changemaker creating pockets of sanctuary for people, wildlife, and the future of the planet. A former social worker retrained in sustainable living, Anna was watching her hometown of Lake Macquarie transform under rapid development. Land clearing, habitat loss, rising temperatures. She knew she couldn't just stand by. Inspired by the work of Japanese botanist Akira Miyake, Anna and her team began planting tiny forests. Dense, biodiverse, self-sustaining ecosystems that grow 10 times faster, 30 times denser, and become 100 times more biodiverse than traditional methods. Hello, Anna. Thank you so much for joining me today. Where did your connection to people and planet actually begin?
Yeah, so I grew up on a 4,500-acre sheep and cattle property in the New England, so between sort of Tamworth and Armidale, up that area in New South Wales. And it is a tiny little place with a very small, but I would say tight-knit community. So I went to a primary school that had 30 children. There was five of us in my class, some of whom I was related to. My dad and my uncle ran our sheep and cattle farm with their father and my great uncle. So we had this kind of family approach to the land. They were third generation farmers. And so I think that kind of rural background, growing up in the country and having a lot of community engagement and input probably really shaped where I am today, which is working in the space of restoring nature, in doing grassroots kind of hands-on action with community.
What role do you think that farming background actually played with your connection to people and planet that we're seeing play out now?
So after I finished school, I moved to Newcastle to go to uni, and I moved to the States and I came back, but I lived in a kind of fairly urban environment for a good 10 to 15 years. And I found once my kids were kind of primary school age, I really had this very deep yearning to get back to the land. There was something that I felt that I was missing, having those green spaces and experiences around me and around my children as well. We didn't have a yard where we were. We had a house, but not really a space. We could walk and we had a dog and things, but I wanted more. I wanted the veggie patch and the chickens and the whole work. So I think there was this kind of deep-seated love of the land that I felt like I needed to return to, and that really started me on this kind of journey of, I was also deeply worried about climate change by this point as well. You know, we were having these extreme heat days. I live in one of the fastest growing areas in Australia, so population growth is just driving land clearing for housing. So we're seeing these deep impacts on biodiversity loss, habitat loss. I was doing lots of projects in my own house, in my own kind of yard, composting and worm farming and creating habitat gardens, but really wanted to do more and had always volunteered for other organizations. So was working with some sustainability organizations and ran some programs with them, but wanted to do more faster. And so created the Groundswell so we could kind of action some of those ideas that we had. So have been doing that for the last 3 years.
What comes through for me in everything I've read about you and seen prior to speaking with you today is that sense of community spirit. And I know farming communities are really well known for that connection and being close to the neighbours, even though they don't live geographically close. So how do you think your family or that community actually influenced how you're so passionate about that today?
I think there was significant role modelling from my parents, and specifically my dad. He was the president of the PNC. He was in the Rural Fire Brigade. He was part of local land care. They were in a tennis club. You know, everything was done. He was a lifelong member of the Lions Club, which was really important to him right throughout his life. It wasn't probably until I was much older and probably much more recently that I have made that link between what was around me and probably what I've become. I don't think I'd really realised the influence he'd had on my life and demonstrating that kind of community spirit that I think is, kind of deep-seated in me that happens now. So I think there is a pretty strong link with how I was raised and what I was exposed to with now how I conduct myself and the work that we do.
One of the other things about grazing, I mean, I've worked extensively with agriculture through Queensland and New South Wales and across sugarcane to horticulture and grazing in sharing stories of farmers and what the challenges are that they face. Land clearing has been, you know, a big thing. And many people are now returning to planting trees and keeping enough roots in the ground to save soils from going into creeks. So when were you first aware of Australia's shameful record on land clearing and our extinction rate?
I remember planting trees as part of a land care project at home on our property when I was probably a late teenager. And it was back when land care planted one type of tree in a paddock on a hill, and we were doing it for shelter belts. So we had sheep, so merinos and fat lambs cross breeds that we bred for the meat, and we had very, very cold winters, like snow and stuff. So we were kind of creating these protection areas and shelter belts and windbreaks, but also trying to regenerate. And we're going back, maybe 15 years later, things that we planted in the freezing cold had died. So some sort of fungus or infection had got in there, and because they were all the same variety, it just wiped out all the work we had done. So I kind of always remember farmers trying to do their bit to give back, and were aware of some of the consequences of the clearing they had, whether it was for cropping or whether it was for livestock. It was probably not until I was much older that I realised that, we have the highest level of land clearing in the developed world. I think we have the fourth highest species extinction rate, which is the highest in the developed world. It was probably only when I got much more into these kind of local solutions to these global problems like climate change and biodiversity loss that I really understood the research about how poorly we're doing in Australia in those kind of areas.
I presume that was through the exposure to your sustainability studies that you were doing. So what was the catalyst to take that knowledge and shift into the Groundswell Collective?
So I had a period in about 2020, so just after the Black Summer bushfires. My dad was really unwell. My daughter was really unwell. I took 12 months leave from work to kind of help care for them. And I went back to uni to study sustainable living. And part of that course was all about how do we create these local actions for global solutions. And that was something that really interested me. I'd already run several community kind of initiatives. You know, I did face mask recycling during COVID because I was just terribly worried about the amount of masks that I could see in our waterways and being just thrown everywhere. I'd done, you know, worm farming for food waste workshops and all sorts of stuff. I'd set up a seed library to work on food security and sovereignty post-COVID as well, when we saw about food shortages and how we were going to be resilient in the future if we had some of these global impacts that we know are coming. So it was really through that studies that I deeply started thinking about what are genuine local solutions to these problems and how can we get them going. I knew that my community had a deep desire to try and somehow regenerate some of the things that we were seeing that was taking place. There was just so many trees being cut down and very little action from our kind of political leaders to do anything about that. So a lot of community spirit and will, but just not somewhere to direct that, I guess. And that's what we hoped we've given people. We've given them somewhere where we say, come with us, we will take practical action, it will make a difference. And hopefully it provides some hope for the future as well.
You're providing a lot of hope after looking at your website prior to this conversation. I see that, you know, you're delivering on the community seed bank where people can borrow, grow, and then obviously share again. But you're also inviting people to your community to plant trees. Part of that is your tiny forest, which completely intrigues me. Why are you so dedicated to that Japanese methodology?
I think what I really love about it is it's evidence-based, right? So it's doing something that makes total practical sense to my mind, maybe not everyone's mind, but certainly my mind, in that we can retrofit these bits of nature back into our urban environments where there is very little space. And we can take underutilized spaces, so bits of grass that are just being watered and mown, and make them into complete small ecosystems rapidly. And to me, that just makes incredible sense. And now that we have done that repeatedly and can show that it works, I think a lot of people are coming on board with that as well. There was certainly some skepticism when I kind of came out and said, I'm going to bring a Japanese planting method and we're going to grow these rapid forests. Like, people were like, sure you are. How's that going to work? But it just, again, coming from that rural background, it made sense. Yep, we loosen the earth because it's so compacted. That makes sense to me. We've had hard-hoofed animals. We've had cars driving over this. We've been running mowers over it for decades. That earth is compacted, so nothing's going to grow quickly. So we loosen it. We improve it with organic material so we know that that soil is healthier. And then we plant what should have been growing there before it was cleared, just more densely. So it's the right plant in the right place that's providing the right food and shelter for our local wildlife. So there's so much of it that had already been proven to work that it's like there's no reason why this shouldn't work in Australia as well.
Why does it need to be so densely planted in such a small footprint? Like, I think tennis court size is the average?
Yeah, that's right. So about 200 square meters. And the benefit of the density is both that it's creating this competition between the plants, which means they're growing very quickly, but it also means it creates a closed canopy. So it's kind of sheltering the ground and shading it, which means there's no ongoing maintenance. So no weeds are coming in because no sunlight's hitting that ground. So having that density is a real benefit to both the plants and kind of the maintenance side of things. Plus, you know, most animals need dense shelter to feel safe. And we can see that there is an overrepresentation of birds, particularly in our urban environments, who have adapted, who are quite aggressive and do well in open spaces like noisy miners and things like that, because there aren't these kind of shelters for our smaller birds that are less aggressive. So hopefully we're creating a little bit more ideal habitat for some of those guys that are losing out.
You've also got carbon sequestration and that density providing cooling to the soil, which in urban spaces is really important because of the heat generation we get in those concrete jungles. So well done.
So we do some temperature studies, and within 12 months, we can cool that local environment by about 5.5 degrees. So very quickly, we can create some localized shading and cooling, which is lovely for people, but also, for wildlife.
The first one you planted was in your hometown, or the one you live in, Lake Macquarie, and it was in 2023. Yep. So almost 3 years on, what impact do you think it's had for that local community?
There are kind of a range of impacts. So first we talked about kind of the environmental impact. So it has grown really quickly. It's doing what we expected it to do in that there is no ongoing maintenance. I think we weeded it maybe twice and have never had to weed it again. That project in particular has like a yarning circle in it, like an outdoor classroom where groups come, or we provide tours and talks, talking about nature-based solutions to climate change, talking about practical action. We run groups with preschoolers there doing nature-based activities. We have celebrations there where we celebrate the birthday of the tiny forest. So there's all these lovely kind of well-being outcomes from that, with people being really, and people are deeply connected to that forest. So the local school came and helped us plant it, as well as having a community planting day. And so one of the outcomes was the school enjoyed that experience so much that one of our next projects was we built a tiny forest in that school. So it's literally been, I guess, the catalyst for other projects. But it is consistently used by the community and is just this beautiful demonstration site now. It has an educative function to it where there's informational signage so people can learn about what we did and how we did it. And then there's kind of the environmental benefits. You know, it's helping flow the water across that site when it floods. It's helping cool the environment. Like you said, it's capturing carbon. It's providing habitat to a range of little bugs and ground dwellers and birds that are coming through there. So heaps and heaps of outcomes.
I can't stop smiling. And every time, you know, we sort of talk about the benefits and you're telling me what you've achieved, sustainability is also connected to the biodiversity, but permaculture principles, right? So they keep popping into my mind along with regenerative principles, because in permaculture, it's not just about how you plant trees or food or whatever. It's about how you structure communities and homes and things like that. So, you know, when I look at that, I think, wow, this is actually capturing a lot of that just through this one initiative, which is absolutely phenomenal. Now, your organization is structured also to be financially sustainable. How have you been able to achieve that?
So our financial model is, I guess, multifaceted. So we're a not-for-profit organization and we have kind of different arms of it. We are contracted to deliver tiny forests at times, so people fund us to deliver them. We have projects where people might have donated to make that happen, so that we have kind of a donation philanthropic kind of arm and are a deductible gift recipient kind of organization through our charity. And then we've done things like crowdfunding before, because we know the community loves what we do. People are happy to chip in to help plant and buy trees. And then we've got other models that are coming in that will generate income as well. We have a children's book that's called The Tiny Forest that is about telling that story of a young girl who saw lots of houses popping up and trees disappearing, and how she wanted to plant a forest at school and how her principal let that happen, which is just another tool that we use to engage people in that conversation. It's a fictional story, I guess, based on a bit of real life. And every school that we plant a tiny forest with gets a copy of that to keep in their library so that the future students kind of know the story behind their tiny forest that's in their playground.
Well, you've just connected deeply with me as a children's author, so I'll definitely want to check that one out. Maybe we can do a swap. I'll send you one of mine if you send me yours. How's that?
I would love that. We have an education kit that goes along with that children's book too, that you can download for free off our website, that is all activities linked to the curriculum that look at science and sustainability, maths, and a range of different topics in there. So if people have a copy of the book, or without a copy of the book, they can just run these kind of sustainability projects that then link back to the curriculum.
This is honestly ticking all of those boxes. Now, you're also a mother. So how have you been able to raise your children with the same awareness of what you've learnt, and how sustainable are they in their vision for the future?
Oh, that's a great question. I was only thinking the other day what has had the biggest impact on my career, and I would have to say definitely becoming a mother. So I feel like I had a clear idea of where my path and life was going, and then I had kids and that just kind of derailed that completely. So my son in particular has several additional needs, so that has been a tricky juggling act for me. And they don't always do me super proud with a lot of things, but I must say they are quite sustainable, both of them. That's one thing I am quite proud of. They're not much into fads or consumerism or any of that sort of stuff, which is pretty impressive because they're 18 and 15 now. So they kind of prime into that age of caring about what other people think and, you know, wearing the right thing and drinking the right thing. They're not into that sort of stuff. So, but they're a tricky little pair.
I think we're going to have another conversation to figure out how you've managed that, because I'm sure there's a lot of parents listening or even teachers. Like, how do we get these children not to care about what they wear or who's more popular?
Yeah, I don't know how much I can take credit for that and how much is just their own personalities, to be honest. They're both fairly confident in themselves, so they have a fair bit of self-confidence, which I think is important. So that means they don't mind if they stick out a little bit, which I think will be a skill for life, hopefully. But I must admit, in other parts of their life, they're probably, you know, not perfect by any stretch.
Anna Noon, if we can only encourage our children to be individuals and to support them through whatever that means, I think that we would be doing the world a great service.
I try.
I learned when we connected this morning that you've launched something new this morning, and I'm really excited to share that with everybody, seeing as it's such a new thing.
We have. So we've launched a Verge Garden program this morning. So we are going to be helping local residents up here in Lake Macquarie in Newcastle maneuver that process around what you can plant and how on these public spaces beyond your kind of boundary. It's not new, and people have been verge gardening for years. A lot of people have been guerrilla verge gardening for a long time. But there is some complexities around it that often make people feel not confident with what you can do in that space. And we know right now we need as much kind of rewilding in our cities as we can possibly afford. So it is a space that's very underutilized at the moment. So we're going to help people work through what are the restrictions, what are the barriers, and how can we overcome those.
Great. I mean, I don't have a verge because we live on acreage, but I see a lot of verges that are definitely in need of attention everywhere, even in regional Australia where I live in Mackay. So one thing, congratulations on that. You know, whatever
Thank
we
you.
Can do to help people understand how to grow something, anything, is fabulous, because we need the world to be more treed. The other thing I wanted to say to you is the last figures I had were 16. You've done 16 tiny forests. Is there an update on that?
Yeah, there's 19 now.
19. Yep. How can we help 19. You to increase that number?
Oh, look, there are two things we are always looking for, I say, is land and money. And my job is often bringing those things together. So sometimes people have the land but not the funding to build a forest, and sometimes people are happy to fund a forest but don't have the land. So if you have either of those things, we would be very, very happy to hear from you. And we don't only plant projects in urban areas. We've definitely done plenty of rural projects for some of the reasons that you talked about. When we're planting a dense space on a rural property, it might be to help with soil erosion. It might be to help with shelter belts. It might be just because people want to regenerate and leave their property a little bit greener than what they inherited it or purchased it. So some people have a lot of land. So, yeah, they can reach out to us through our website, which is thegroundswell.org.au, and we can talk to them about what's possible.
Well, I'm looking forward to what's possible, because even in the last 3 years, you've achieved something phenomenal, and I look forward to helping you grow that exponentially. Thanks, Anna.
Well, thank you, Kim. It's been lovely.
Co-founder of the Groundswell Collective, Anna Noon. When we talk about the future we're leaving our children, we often think in abstract terms, or even perhaps legacy. A tiny forest is more than trees. It's community connection, biodiversity returning, cooler streets. It's children watching insects return to spaces that were once barren. In a country facing extraordinary environmental challenges, this is a story of practical hope. Inspired by today's conversation? Why not share it with someone who cares about people, planet, and possibility? Or if you'd like to support or partner with the Groundswell Collective, you'll find all the links in my show notes. Because what we restore today will shape the world our children inherit tomorrow. Thank you once again for being part of this community. I value your support. And if you have any input for the show, please reach out and connect with me. All of my contacts are also in the show notes, or you can follow me on social media. Next week, a very special episode that will be broadcast around the world as part of Podcastthon. My friend Shakira Todd, who founded Wildlife Surrounds Conservation Fund, is my guest. She'll share her story about connection to nature and how she shares her knowledge and wisdom with future generations from all around the world.